Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Dan Lynch joins me. We're going to be talking about how to synchronize your .dot files across multiple machines. Wow, you're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch. Episode 556, recorded November 20th, 2019. Chez moi. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including solutions from key partners like VMware. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. And by Cachefly. Give your users the seamless online experience they want. Power your site or app with Cachefly CDN, Content Delivery Network, and be 30% faster than the competition. Learn more at twit.cachefly.com. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you might want to download right after this show and play with. I think today will be one of those. Joining me once again is Dan Lynch. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's good to be back.
And it's been so long since we've seen you.
It's been a whole 7 days. Yeah, a whole 7 days. Yeah.
Well, 7 days minus 2 hours.
true.
Takes time to actually, well, about 1 hour, I guess. Today is a, by the way, I should probably describe where I'm at. I'm at ZipRecruiter's headquarters this week. 2 weeks a year, they call in all the remotes and have all hands meetings and parties. And, we get free food, like both lunch and breakfast and sometimes dinner. So it's a pretty fun week to be here, especially because I get to see a lot of people that I only get to see online most of the time. And so I used to come down to ZipRecruiter like 1 week a month, and then I realized how much money I was spending for how little return I was getting. So I said, screw it. I'm just going to work remote all the time, and I only come on site for the all hands weeks, which are only 2 weeks a year. So this is one of those weeks. I'm in the Newport room. I have been here before. I don't know how long ago it was, but I know I definitely have been in this room before. And the conference is currently going on. I'm missing the first round of seminars today, but I don't care. I'm going to go over there as soon as I can finish the show. Today's project is Chez moi, which I've been mispronouncing all the way the last many, many, many months. So basically what Chez moi does is it synchronizes your .dot files in your home directory. This is really handy, especially if you're like many people where you have many machines that you use, maybe even things like a server that has configuration files, and your laptop has configuration files, and how do you bring those together? It looks like the underpinning structure is with Git. I know people have built various Git solutions, but the biggest problem with Git solutions seems to be that it wants to like take over the entire directory. And Tom Paine, the creator of Chez moi, will be on in a few minutes telling us how he fixed that. So how does he actually using Git and only controlling some of the files, which is fascinating to me. And it looks well documented. It runs on multiple platforms. It looks like a lot of fun. What do you think so far, Dan?
Yeah, this one's really interesting to me personally, because I, for a long time, used to change my Linux distribution every week, not just because I'm a sadist or whatever, but because I wanted to test them properly. I used to review them, and then I used to just obviously manually copy over my configuration files and all the bash aliases and all your .dot files, as you call them, and so on. And this would have been really useful for me. And it's obviously, I do have many machines now that I need to kind of synchronize, so I'm very, very interested in this one.
Yeah, and this is one of those shows again that was brought to us by y'all trying to get on the show. So that's the way almost all my shows are done these days, is people are suggesting, I either go talk to somebody or they have somebody talk to me And that's how we fill the shows. And what's great is we're filled all the way to the end of January. I've got to open up February and March now so that I can actually, you know, enroll new guests. So thank you all for the work you do to bring me more guests, because that always makes my work a little bit easier. Anything further, Dan, before I read the ad and get into the show?
No, let's do it.
Okay. So before we bring Tom on, we want to say that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. WWT began building their Advanced Technology Center, ATC, 10 years ago and has grown exponentially. It's like no other testing and research lab. The lab contains more than $500 million in equipment from hundreds of OEMs and key partners ranging from high-tech heavyweights like VMware, Dell EMC, and Microsoft to emerging disruptors like Equinix. WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right. Their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation and offers on-demand and schedulable labs like VMware Cloud on AWS, along with hundreds of other labs representing the newest advances in network virtualization, software-defined data center, security, digital workspace, multi-cloud architecture, and automation, and more. Learn about products before you launch. WWT engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proofs of concept and pilots using the sandbox so customers can confidently select the best solutions. In many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increases speed to market. They offer lab as a service, a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Here, customers can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystems that WWT has already built. It's virtual, so you can take full advantage of ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. WWT engineers work in these labs every day, beta testing new solutions based on the latest and greatest VMware technologies, and building reference architectures and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster with much less investment. WWT has launched their new digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. The ecosystem creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world for their customers. Get access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more about ATC and get insights into their newest features, go to wwt.com/twit. WWT simplifies the complex. That's wwt.com/twit. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. And we thank WWT for their sponsorship of Floss Weekly. And now let's go ahead and bring on Tom Payne. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm from my flat in Zurich, in Switzerland.
Cool, cool. So you're over sort of near Dan, not really. And we actually didn't say where Dan's coming in from, but he's always coming in from Liverpool, so we don't ask him that anymore.
Yep.
Anyway, so give us the 30,000-foot view. What problem is this solving that somebody would reach for Chamois?
Chamois helps you manage your dot files across different machines. It's absolutely fantastic if you've got a different set of machines at home or machines at work, and you want to share the stuff that's in common between them, your bash config, your git config, etc., while coping with differences from machine to machine, and also being able to keep all the secrets that occasionally have to end up in the config files secure.
And I see you're using Git. How are you not like clobbering the entire home directory?
So under the hood, you tell Chamois what state you'd like your dot files to be in, what you want in your home directory. Chamois then reads this from a Git repository, and then, or Git working copy, I should say, and then updates the files in your home directory to be exactly what you want them to be. So it uses Git as the underlying store mm-hmm. for your config files. It uses Git for distributing them amongst machines, but provides one-line commands to make it an update or a push very quick.
And how did this get started?
It's a scratch to personal itch. For a long time, I used Puppet to manage my configuration files. Puppet's quite a large beast these days mm-hmm. and has way more functionality than you really need for just something in your home directory. Also, I had increasingly a diverse range of machines, everything from a bit of FreeBSD to Raspberry Pis to Linux machines to Macs, my MacBook laptop. And installing Puppet on all of these becomes quite painful. I wanted a single binary that I could download with one command and then just with single second command, set up all my .dot files on a new machine and also transfer changes between them.
And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think this runs everywhere that you can run a Go binary and has Git, right?
Exactly. In fact, the Git is pluggable. You can use any version control system you want. It's got out-of-the-box support for Mercurial as well. I imagine most people are using Git, but you could use CVS or Subversion if you wanted. And yeah, one of the reasons for choosing Go is because it creates cross-compilations very easy. It supports a very wide range of platforms. And Shaymoir has releases for pretty much everything supported by Go. All different architectures, Intel, ARM, PPC, etc., all different operating systems, FreeBSD, Linux, even Windows is supported.
And how difficult is this to get started with?
For Shaymoir? It's a few lines. You install Shaymoir with a single command. You run Shaymoir add, the name of the file you want Shaymoir to manage. And then that automatically adds it to what's called the source state, which is the source of what of how you want everything to be. And then on another, you push that to your Git repository. And to get it onto another machine, it's Shaymoir init URL to your Git repository, and a single command brings it onto a new machine.
Wow.
So it's very quick to get started. Yeah.
So you achieve a shared state across machines by having a Git repository somewhere, obviously somewhere up, like up in GitHub or maybe a private Git repository, right?
Exactly. That's it. I mean, one of the goals between Shaymoir is to do follow the Unix philosophy and just do one thing well. And for distributing code across multiple machines, Git already solves this fantastically. Shaymoir helps you use Git in this way. It can automatically push and pull for you. But the goal is really build on Git strengths.
And what happens if I edit the same file two different ways? That would normally cause a merge conflict, right?
Yeah, so this is something which is handled okay at the moment in Shaymoir, but I hope will improve in the next few weeks. So at the moment, there are effectively two steps. Firstly, you pull what you want for your Git repository. That becomes the source state. Then Shaymoir computes what you want the state to be in your home directory to be, and Shaymoir does that update from source state to home directory. If you've already modified a file in your home directory and not told Shaymoir about it, the next time you run Shaymoir update, it will overwrite your changes. I'll soon be adding a feature to automatically detect when a file has been modified outside of Shaymoir, and it'll fire up either do nothing, warn you, fire up a three-way merge tool. So at the moment it overwrites, but that behavior will become configurable.
That sounds excellent. And so one of the things I like about this, Tom, Randall's already said it, is that you can run it on so many different platforms and so on. Was that the thinking behind choosing Go? Why did you particularly choose Go for developing this?
Yeah, that's exactly the reason. I'm very familiar with Go. I've been using it as my primary language for about 5 or 6 years now. And it has this single binary statically linked feature. Easy cross-compilation makes Go a perfect fit. Scripting language is always a little bit harder to get the interpreter installed. Something like Rust is clearly a fantastic language, but probably overkill. For this sort of systems programming, Go is a very good fit.
Excellent. And it seems I haven't never really done much with Go, I've got to be honest, but it does seem like a good choice for that kind of thing. How many people are using this at the moment? Do you know how many users you have, and how's it kind of taken off?
I don't have an exact number of users. It's coming up to 2,000 stars on GitHub, which I'm quite proud of. My previous best open source project managed 250 stars after about 6 years. So to get almost 2,000 in 1 year, I'm very happy with. There was initial surge. I announced it on Hacker News about 9 months ago, which gave it a good boost. And more recently, I think it's just been incremental traffic, people discovering it. And I hope that people through this Floss Weekly podcast will discover it and find it useful too.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and we hope that many people will too. I'm sure they will. We had there's some other tools that kind of do this sort of thing, and I'm frantically looking through my email because we had an email from Michael Tunnell, who is a part-time co-host as well on this. He was asking, he wanted us to ask how this compares to, I don't even know how you say this, YADM? Yadam, is
that? Yadam.
He was interested in the comparisons between Chamois and that.
Yeah, to be honest, I haven't looked particularly closely at Yadam. I know it solves the same sort of problem. There's some overlap in the way that Yadam and Chamois store the initial state. I wrote Chamois very much to scratch my own personal itch and only discovered about Yadam afterwards. But that said, I think some of the things that make Chamois particularly different from Yadam are the rich templating system that Chamois has. You can use the full power of Go's text template syntax to customize any dot file on any machine as much as you want. The distribution is easier with a single binary. I think Yadam, if I remember correctly, is distributed as a bash script. Mm-hmm. And the integration with various password managers, I think, is unique to Chamois and is a real strong point in Chamois' favor. Mm. A lot of people also use or have used a system called GNU-STO, which manages dot files by making them symlinks into some sort of source directory. But that has a couple of downsides. One is that it's very hard to cope with differences from machine to machine. And secondly, that your dot files are not actually files anymore. They're symbolic links, which can cause problems in some cases. Chamois means that your dot files really are just the normal files and directories that you have in your home directory if you weren't using Chamois. So all your software should behave correctly.
Yeah, and of course that means as well that you're not... if I, for whatever reason, remove Chamois, it's not going to break everything as well, which must be really important.
Exactly. And I think it's a very important feature for software that it should be as easy to stop using as easy as to start using. And this encourages people to explore that, see if it fits their needs. Chamois is exactly like this. It also has an archive command, so you can just generate a tarball of all your dot files, which is great if you want to back them up somewhere, copy them onto another machine that Chamois doesn't run on or doesn't have network access or whatever. So being able to move your data in and out very easily was an important part of Chamois' design.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that makes total sense. I was curious about whether Chamois has a concept of, obviously if I'm using it to sync between different machines, could I tell it to send different things to different machines? What I mean is, could I tell it to say, I only want this, you know, these files to go to machine A, whereas these files and some others could go to machine B?
Yes, you can. In fact, what happens, Chamois has a single source of truth, which is in a single set of dot files or these templates, but they can then be interpreted or executed differently on different machines. You can include or exclude files on specific machines. For example, on my work machine, I have configuration files which I don't need on my home machines, so they're only installed on my work machines. For me, having the single source of truth makes things a lot easier to manage. Often it's only small differences between machines. So you'll get config at home, you want your personal email address in there. At work, you want your work email address there for your commits. So this is a lot easier to manage with a template and a single source of truth.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. So is it just yourself that's working on this, or is there anyone else in the team?
It's mainly me, but I had some really nice contributions. I think it's up to about 80 forks now. I've had probably about 100 or so pull requests and some really nice contributions. Someone, I don't even know the person's name, just their GitHub handle, the ZB140, contributed all the Windows support, which I really, really appreciated. This person did a massive job there. There are a lot of subtle differences between POSIX or Linux type systems and Windows. And this person went through and made it everything very compatible with Windows. I'm very appreciative of that. Also, the communities have been a fantastic source of ideas and improvements of Shamwa. People are out actively using it and have come up with ways to really make the whole experience much smoother and easier to use. So thanks very much to all the people who've submitted issues and on GitHub there.
And you've kind of answered a question I was going to ask, which is, are you taking pull requests for this? Clearly you are.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to submit a pull request, I'm extremely happy to receive them. If it's something significant, I'll ask, please raise a discussion or raise an issue about it first. It has been the case that people have put a lot of effort into making pull requests, but they haven't solved quite the right problem or they haven't followed the coding standards. So please, if you want to, I'm very open to submissions, but please read the contributing docs.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I was curious about something I should have asked a minute ago. When you talked about Windows support, Windows doesn't use .dot files in the same way, does it? So what kind of things are we syncing between, say, like a Linux machine and a Windows machine?
So, yeah, I mean, normal Windows software will store its config in the registry or whatever. I'm not super familiar with Windows, to be honest. But people are using things like MSys and Sigwin on Windows machines, which are much more Linux-like or sort of normal POSIX shell-type environments. And I believe, in fact, the person who submitted the pull request for Windows is actually using multiple of these systems on a single Windows machine, as well as syncing this with Linux.
Okay, excellent. Yeah. I was going to ask about Sigwin before when you said somebody had made it work well on Windows. I was wondering, had they just somehow run it through Sigwin, which I've tried in the past, but it hasn't worked. I did once many moons ago find that, this is probably just my fault, but find that the easiest way for me to back up some data was to run rsync through Sigwin on a Windows machine and send it to another one that way. That might just be my preference for using rsync, I think, but it was an interesting way of doing it. So what license is it under and why did you choose that?
It's under the MIT license. Really, there's nothing groundbreaking in Shamwa. There's no deep intellectual property. It's something that I wrote to be useful to me. I've put it out there in a form that I hope is useful to others. So really, I wanted the most open, permissive license possible. So the MIT is pretty much that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. A kind of permissive... if you want a permissive license, obviously. So you mentioned that you've got, I think, 84 different forks of this. So it sounds like it's really kind of been embraced or taken off quite nicely. Is that really satisfying to see?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, I'm still at the stage of every time someone stars the repo, I check out who they are and I see where they're using it. And it's a real buzz to see that it's used all over the world now. Many people in many different organizations, many different countries. That's really rewarding.
Excellent. And I suppose there probably isn't much kind of call for this, but I was going to say, because you've got lots of people in different countries using it, is there any call for, you know, internationalization of your docs and stuff? Because you've got a lot of documentation and I imagine, you know, getting it translated in different languages and stuff, that's quite a big job.
Yeah, it's, I haven't had any requests for it yet. And the tech world pretty much runs in English. And Shamwa itself is designed to operate very much like Git in the way that the commands are structured. So I'd be very willing, very happy for people to submit translations. But I think given that the audience is generally technical power users, they probably already read enough English that the English documentation is sufficient. The name, of course, Shamwa, is actually French. I did live in France for a few years, and I do speak French. And Shamwa means at my house, which is somehow relevant to home directories.
Well, I can't let Dan... Sorry, go ahead. Were you finished?
Yeah.
Okay. I can't let Dan have all the fun, so I'm going to take it back over for a little bit. But before I ask my questions that I've been preparing, I have to say that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by CashFly. Give your users the seamless online experience they want. Power up your site or app with CashFly CDN and be 30% faster than the competition. No matter what industry your business is in, if your website is directly tied to company revenue, give your customers the fast downloads they need with CashFly. CashFly CDN delivers rich media content up to 10 times faster than traditional delivery methods and up to 30% faster than other major CDNs. Backed by 100% SLA, CashFly guarantees the best user experience for all your customers, no matter where they are or what device they're on. Join the thousands of others who trust CashFly's reliable network, including LG, Microsoft, Adobe, and Ars Technica. TWiT has been hosting all of their podcasts, audio and video, on CashFly for a decade. Every month, our viewers and listeners download petabytes of data fast and flawlessly. TWiT wouldn't exist without CashFly. Say goodbye to logging in multiple times a week, or worse, even daily, trying to track your CDN usage. No billing spikes. Get a custom plan tailored to your CDN based on yearly usage trends. On average, customers who switch to CashFly save more than 20%. Just imagine what you could do with that 20% and your time. And just for TWiT listeners, CashFly is giving away a complimentary, detailed analysis of your current CDN bill and usage trends. See if you're overpaying 20% or more for CDN. Learn more at twit.cashfly.com. That's twit.cashfly.com. And we thank CashFly for their support of Floss Weekly. And now, let me see, where was the question I was going to ask? Yes. Oh, so I'm going through the documentation. I see that you use this thing called Text Template. What is that, and why did you choose that?
So Text Template is part of the Go standard library. It's Go's template language, basically. I used it simply because it comes out of the box with Go. It's been it's clearly the result of a lot of experience with other templating languages, and is very quick and simple to learn and already fully documented and implemented. So it was a great choice for me.
Oh, so you didn't create that? Yeah. Okay.
No, this is part of the Go standard library. Also hooked in there is a project called github.com/masterminds/sprig, which is a selection of idempotent hermetic functions for the text template language. So the text template language itself comes with the Go standard library. The library of template functions comes from masterminds/sprig. Which adds a lot of richness and power to what you can do with the templates.
Cool. And it's not difficult to learn?
No, it's very similar to Mustache or other templating languages.
Is this also the thing that decides whether something gets installed at all or not?
Yes. So for that, by default, everything is installed. One of the concepts behind Shema is that the source state, the sort of the where you declare what you want your dot files to be, should be very easy to understand as a human. You can go in there, poke around with ls and cat, and everything should make sense. Sorry, where's going with this? For this reason, if something's a template, it'll have a .tmpl extension. You'll see .bash.template, for example. This makes I've lost the train of it here. If you, by default, anything is installed. If you everything is installed. Consequently, it's a little bit weird, but if you don't want something to be installed, then you tell Shemar, don't install this on this machine. There's a file called .shemar-ignore, which is very similar, the same syntax as a .git-ignore file, which is also templates. You can control which files don't get installed on different machines.
Okay, that makes sense. And also, I think early in the show, you said that Puppet was like too heavyweight to be useful, and that's part of why you created Shemoa. But let's go the other direction. At what point does Shemoa run out of steam such that you'd want to go back to using Puppet?
So Shemoa is very much focused on managing files in your home directory. It's not a full system managed. It does have support for scripting that you can have, run these scripts every time I run an update, or run this script just once when I'm setting up a machine. This is great for installing all the packages you want as part of a machine setup, for example. But if you want a full system management thing, like starting daemons, installing what system level packages, creating different users, then you're definitely out of the realm of Shenmue, and you should look at something like Salt or Ansible or Chef or Puppet. But by keeping Shenmue focused on the home directory stuff, I hope to have a smaller, simpler tool.
And what kind of variables does the template have access to?
So there's a bunch of default variables that you get. For example, the operating system, the host name, your username, stuff passed from the Linux LSB or Linux Standard Base release file, etc. OS release. But you're also free to define your own variables in a config file. I use this to, for example, control which GPG keys I use for signing my Git commits on different machines. This is a variable under my control.
And I understand you have special processes for handling secrets.
Yes. This is something which I didn't anticipate at the start, but sort of discovered in the process of using Shenmue. So Shenmue talks to your password manager, basically. I personally use LastPass to store my secrets, and now in the templating language, I can call to LastPass and say, give me my GitHub access token, or give me the password for something that needs to be in a .NET RC file or similar. This has turned out to be a very useful feature. This way, all my secrets stay safe in my password manager. They're protected by two-factor authentication, etc., all the security that your good password manager brings. And it means that on any individual machine, the only secrets that end up in plain text on that machine are the ones that have to be on that machine. And this is great because it means, for example, if you want to, you've got your personal configuration files for your home systems, you want to take those config files over to your work machine, but you don't want your work system administrator to be able to poke around your home directory and see secrets that are related to your home machine. And similarly, the other way around, you don't want your work secrets on your home laptop. So by putting your secrets in a password manager and using Shenmue's integration for this, you get all this security. And Shenmue has out-of-the-box support for pretty much all of them. 1Password, LastPass, Vault, GoPass, Pass. You can also encrypt entire files of GPG. This means you can make your .dot files to repository public as well. You don't have to keep stuff in secret because all your secrets are either encrypted or in the password manager.
I suspect that means there's some sort of API for things like LastPass and 1Password that you're able to tap into.
Yeah, exactly. All of these things come with command line tools that allow you to quiz them. And the output, Shenmue intelligently parses the output of each of them. For example, if they're returning a structured JSON object with different fields of username, password, etc., you can you can pick these things out. And this is all out of the box with Shenmue.
Well, it sounds like you've got everything, including the kitchen sink, in there so far. What are you still missing? What's the big gap so far?
The thing I'm really excited for now coming actually was a suggestion from made by one of the issues, and it goes back to what I mentioned earlier, saying that if the stuff has changed, if you've changed stuff outside Shenmue, the next time you run a Shenmue update, it'll overwrite your changes. So what I'm going to add is Shenmue is going to track the last contents it wrote to a file, and it will check to see if the file has changed outside of Shenmue before overwriting it. And this is, and it will then prompt you to either do a three-way merge, ignore the changes, or whatever you want to do. And this will make Shenmue very safe by default. There are a number of programs that modify the config files. Number of programs that modify their own config files. Sometimes you will modify a config file and forget to tell Shenmue that you've changed the config files. Your changes will get overwritten next time. This will fix all of that. And much of the infrastructure is already in place. Shamwell will just simply store a checksum of the file contents each time it writes a file, check that checksum before rewriting a file, and if in the event of a change, warn you. So that's the next big task, which I hope to get out in the next few weeks. And with that, Shamwell is approaching completeness, I think. And certainly I'm looking forward to do a version 2 release before Christmas, and sort of the one-year anniversary of Shamar's initial release.
And one of the things I noticed going through the FAQ, I think this is your project, I'm trying to remember, or I've seen so much stuff this morning, I have no idea, but it seems like you have a consistent dash N and dash V, and that's really good user interface, if that's your project, right? That's your project.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
So for me, this is very important. So Shamwell also makes a lot of effort to be reliable and transparent. For example, one of the things that's not very evident, but does happen under the hood, is that Shamwell atomically replaces your .dot files. I.e., you either get the old version of your .dot file or the updated of the version of your .dot file, but never something partially in between. This is done using a library, github.com/google/rename.io. It's a small Go library, open source by Michael Stableberg. And this makes Shamwell safe in the event of its run being interrupted for whatever reason. So you can never end up with partially created files. The N and the V. Allow you, Shamwell has both a verbose mode, so you see exactly what changes it is making or will make if you Shamwell diff. It prints diffs just like git diff. And the N is a dry run mode, and this tells you exactly what Shamwell would do without actually doing it, which is absolutely great because for testing changes or just building confidence that Shamwell is making the changes that you want. Dot files, although there's people don't have very many of them. You know, we're typically talking about managing between 5 and 50 files. It's not many, but they are very important and very personal. So it's important that you get what you want.
Well, Dan's got some more questions, but I want to ask one very important question because the chat room asked it, which is, when are you going to add blockchain?
Sorry, could you repeat the question, please?
when are you going to add blockchain?
As in file watching. interesting idea. At the moment, I'd be very happy to discuss this on GitHub. At the moment, I like it that it only runs when the user wants it to run. File watching could be added, but probably doesn't make much sense unless you have automatic pushing and sharing of the .dot files between machines.
Or I think you misunderstood the question. Blockchain is like the basis of Bitcoin. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I thought you said watching as in file watching, Myra. No. So, well, Git is already uses a blockchain as its underlying data store. The DAG in Git is or Merkle graph. So it's already got blockchain.
All right, Dan, over to you.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. We haven't had anyone say that before, actually, who has Git involved in their project. Tom, I was reading through your bio, and I was really interested in some of the stuff you've got in there. So you're a Gentoo guy, right? You were a Gentoo developer, is that right?
Yeah, I was a Gentoo developer for many years, about 2003 to 2008. I'm onto Ubuntu now, but I was very good days in the early days of Gentoo.
So that was going to be one of my follow-up questions was, do you still run Gentoo? So you've moved on to Ubuntu now.
Yeah, I have a lot of fondness in my heart for Gentoo. But I think there was one, I really liked the everything being at the bleeding edge. But I think there was one system to update or one emerge too many, which broke my bootloader. And I switched at that point.
And I've only used Gentoo in passing, I've got to be honest. I used Arch quite a lot more, which is, you know, a little bit similar in some ways if you want the bleeding edge stuff. But like you said, I used to have a lecturer at college years ago who used to say the cutting edge is also the bleeding edge, and, you know, and often things will break. And I think I spent about a day installing Arch and completely building it from scratch. And then about 4 days later, I updated something and it just went wrong. And I thought, I can't be bothered doing that again. Yeah. But no, I mean, Gentoo's still going strong. I mean, I've pulled it onto Arch now, but Gentoo's still going strong. And did you ever use any of things like Savion, which would pull in binaries as well as the traditional Gentoo, you know, way of building or making all the software?
I haven't used Savion for building releases of Shenmue. I use a fantastic open source project called Go Releaser, where you effectively write a config file. You say, I want binaries built for all of these architectures and all of these operating systems, and I want packages built for all of these different operating systems. So it generates RPM packages, deb packages, zip files for Windows, Scoop installers for Windows, Snap binaries for Linux systems, and a whole host more. It's an absolutely fantastic project, which has really enabled Shenmue to be so available for such a wide variety of systems. The developer, Carlos, is very friendly and very responsive. If you're developing and distributing Go binaries, I strongly recommend checking out goreleaser.com.
Excellent. I mean, that sounds really useful because, I mean, trying to target all of these different endpoints or platforms must be really difficult. So having the tool that can, you know, automatically do that must be really, really good. Something else I wanted to ask you about was I noticed on your bio that you work writing Go code for air traffic control stuff for drones. Is that right? Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm working for a company called AirMap, who are headquartered in Santa Monica. We're working with the FAA, particularly in the US, and SkyGuide, which is the company that does all the air traffic control systems for Switzerland, here in Switzerland, amongst others. And AirMap as a company provides services for basically enabling loads more drones to fly in airspace. We do things like we know about air law. We can get you flight authorizations. We can automate. We can make sure you're following the rules. We can automate. We can automatically approve your flights. We can show you what other traffic, both manned and unmanned, is flying in your area. We've got remote ID that we're working with a number of other companies on, so you can look at a drone in the sky and know who the pilot is and what the drone is, what the drone's mission is. It's a really fun space to be in. I've particularly keen interest in this as I'm a paraglider pilot in my spare time, so I'm used to dealing with airspace and flying objects. And the tech stack is Go and Geospatial Go.
Wow, that's amazing. I was curious about, I don't know if you've seen this, I only found out about this recently, just in passing. I've never got into the whole drone thing. I haven't either had time or whatever. Mm-hmm. I know lots of people who are in makerspaces and stuff that I've been involved with, obviously they love drones. In the UK now, they're bringing in a law to license drones. So by the end of this month, as we're speaking, November, they're saying anybody who hasn't got their drone registered could be in trouble, basically. But they want them to have like license numbers and stuff. Have you heard about that? And what do you think about that for an idea?
Yeah, I mean, it's effectively a necessity, really. I think the US already has its Part 107 rules. The UK is one of the first to require registration of drones and pilots. The same will be arriving in Switzerland, I think, next year. This is only for drones larger than a certain size, I hasten to add. If you go buy a little toy drone that's, you know, weighs 30 grams, you don't have to bother about that. But anything that's big enough to hurt someone if it falls out of the sky, it will need to be registered. I think it's a necessity, really. Drones have a lot of positive uses. They also have a lot of not so positive uses.
Yeah, I mean, recently in the UK, the Gatwick Airport stuff, where they had last year, I think it was, twice in the space of like a week, protesters were shut down the whole of Gatwick Airport, which is quite a big airport, just by flying drones across the runway and stuff. And that's massive. That must have cost so much money to the airlines and the airport, and also dangerous as well.
Yeah. It's the obviously any technology can be used for good or bad, and drones included. At AirMap, we're very much focused on the positive uses of drones, and we want to enable drone traffic for all the good stuff, you know, everything from deliveries, search and rescue, surveying, all of these different rich applications. That's, people, even with drone registration, people will still be home building their drones, which don't have registration. They will, if people want to fly them illegally, they can. There's no way to stop that. You have to find out, come up with different thing, ways of solving the problem there.
You mentioned about you're developing software, obviously, for keeping an eye on air traffic, airspace, all that kind of stuff. Does that mean that you have to deal with things like, obviously, air traffic control systems, anything like that has to be, I think they call it safety critical systems. You know, they have to be tested and double tested and triple tested or whatever, because people's lives could depend on it. Did you hit those kind of things as well?
Yeah, it's definitely a... how to put it, a challenge that we're facing at AirMap is that historically the aviation industry has been very, very conservative, and things change on the scale of one change every decade. And once things are certified, they never change. AirMap is a California startup company, is iterating very fast indeed, and probably in some cases a little too fast. And so we're still working out how to find the right balance between the development velocity that you get from a startup with the traditionally very conservative aviation industry. And that's something we're working very closely with SkyGuide and the Civil Federal Office of Civil Aviation here in Switzerland and others.
When you said AirMap was in Santa Monica, I went, well, I'm in Santa Monica right now. It must be, the headquarters must be close by somewhere, right? Do you know what streets are on?
Yeah, they're on Santa Monica Boulevard around the junction of 5th and 6th, I think.
Oh, that's like a block and a half that way. It's right there.
Just opposite REI.
Yes, that's a block and a half that way. So,
well, I should drop in and say hi there.
Yeah, nice he's dropping us. I talked to Tom Payne on this morning on Skype. So, wow, cool. Well, we're almost out of time. And I'd like to give guests a chance at this point to cover anything that we didn't cover yet. Is there anything we've left out in our questioning?
One thing I'm quite proud about ShameWire is the documentation. Actually, this is from speaking to friends who are technical writers at various different companies. And I think for open source projects, particularly where you don't have someone you can call at the end of the phone, documentation is very important. So I've gone to a lot of efforts. I've created everything from an install guide, a quick start to get you started, how to achieve specific tasks, so FAQ, and a full reference manual of documenting everything about ShameWire for using it. I've also built this into the binaries, again, from a single source of truth. So when you type ShameWire help, for example, actually pulls text from the reference manual. It's automatically extracted from the reference manual. There's a ShameWire docs command that gives all the documentation embedded in the binary. So once again, it's just a single thing to distribute. ShameWire docs reference gives you the entire reference manual on your screen. And I think as ShameWire is only me as the sort of key developer at the moment, and it's a reasonable large number of users now, I think the only way to scale an open source project is to provide good documentation. So that's, I'm proud of what we've done with ShameWire.
Cool. Well, that's really a good thing too, because I know so many open source projects, the documentation seems to be sort of second thought, you know, not a primary concern. So we end up with projects that are unusable because, as I used to get trained when I was back in my early days of being a technical writer, if you can't read it from the docs, it doesn't exist in the product, because the doc is the product for the people that are using it.
Yeah, that makes lots of sense. Good insight.
Yeah. Cool. Well, like I said, we're almost out of time. I have two more questions I must ask. Or people yell at me. They don't yell at me, but they send me email with cap letters, you know, so that's yelling. What's your favorite scripting language?
I've used Python a lot. Yeah, that's what I reach for by default now. I was a long-term Ruby user for about 10 years. But yeah, Python is my favorite scripting language.
And what text editor do you use?
I was a long-time Vim user. But more recently, I've switched to VS Code, which is a fantastic project. Yeah,
VS Code's amazing. It's I'm using it for all my Flutter work, all my Dart and Flutter work. And I didn't believe I would like an IDE, although I've used Emacs all these years. So I guess I just an IDE, but just I'm used to the way it works. But VS Code is amazing. It surprises me. I should stop talking about it this way, but it surprises me that Microsoft is releasing this level of quality of open source code and has really fully embraced the open source community now. It's almost like some of their sins from 20 years ago are being erased. Yeah. Just a little bit at a time.
I totally agree with you.
Oh, no, my lights went out again. Hold on. Come on. Here we go.
It's because you mentioned Microsoft. You mentioned Microsoft and that, and then somebody just went, switch that off.
Yeah, it's true, right? Yeah. Maybe they're listening to the show and they remotely checked into the lights. For those of you who aren't watching the video, you missed something. You should probably download the video and go right to this moment in the screen here, because I'm in a room that has a motion sensitive light, and if you don't move around for a while, it goes, "Oh, there's nobody in here," and I'm sitting relatively still. So every once in a while, I've got to like wave at the stupid light. Anyway, that's done. Well, Tom, it's been great having you on the show. I think I may even use this because I do have multiple machines and I like to manage that. Because it's got Git underneath the hood, does it also maintain a history that I could actually see how my dot files have changed over the years?
Yeah, exactly. So, yes. Or I mean, you don't have to use this, but yes. I mean, normally you would check everything into Git. And have all the advantages that Git brings.
Yeah, nice, cool. Well, like I said, interesting project, solves an important niche, an important problem, and sounds like you're coming along quite well with it. So thanks for coming on the show and talking about Chez Moi.
Thank you very much, Randall and Dan. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Very good, very good. That was Tom Payne talking to us about his pet project, Chez Moi. Well, not just pet, it works. It's a working thing. It makes things. Yeah, I don't want to dismiss that. It looks mature. It looks like it's really well done. And I really encourage people to take a look at it. The URL for it, of course, will be in the show notes. I don't want to try to explain a GitHub URL here. But anyway, it's in GitHub. Dan, what do you think?
So you mentioned that you may well install this and try it, Randall. I can one-up you on that because I've actually installed it while we were talking, doing the show. I haven't done much with it yet, I'll be honest, but I have just installed it and I'll figure out the docs and stuff. But yeah, I installed the deb package from the GitHub there, and it works great on I'm on Linux Mint 19.2, and it worked fine. So I'm gonna have to learn how to use it now, but it sounds really, really useful, and it's really nice to see that, you know, someone I mean, this is the thing that we see a lot in open source software, but someone scratching their own itch. How many things have started, in fact, in the free and open source world is from that. But it's great when you see something like this, that someone started it, scratched their own itch, and then kind of the rest of the world almost has gone, hey, that's great, we want that too, and jumped on board. So it's really nice. Tom's doing really good work, and I can't wait to figure out how to actually use Chez Moi now that I've installed it.
I could say you pulled a Leo back when Leo was on the show. Almost every show, he would install whatever it is we were talking about during the show. And so it was kind of fun to watch him do that. So I don't know if he still does it on other shows, but definitely on this show, he was pretty much installing everything we were talking about. So you pulled the Leo. I'm interested to hear about your success about that and all that stuff. So, and I may install it too. We'll see. Don't have enough hours in the day yet, but that's the way it works. So let me talk about who's coming up, because we have a full schedule all the way out to the end of January. So LS Quick is Lightspeed Quick. The LS Quick library is an open source implementation of QUIC and HTTP3 functionality for servers and clients. XWiki is can create either traditional wikis or structured wikis that trigger actions based on things you upload to the various pages. Yugabyte, which is a distributed SQL, high-performance, global replication, internet scale. Ooh, internet scale. Rollisteam is a virtual tabletop software. It helps you manage tabletop role-playing games with remote friends and players. It provides many features to share maps, pictures, and also includes tools to communicate with your friends and players. When you want to play a tabletop game, but you don't want to go over to their house, I guess that makes sense. Titan makes it easy to run your favorite database in Docker container on your laptop, but with the power of versioning the underlying data. So imagine Git for data, not just software. Kong is a next-generation API platform for multi-cloud and hybrid organizations. We had them on about a year and a half ago, but they tried to convince me, or they have convinced me, because otherwise I wouldn't let them back on, that there's been a significant change. I think it's Kong 2.0 came out, and so they want to talk to us about what the new version actually is all about. It connects all your microservices and APIs with the industry's most performant, scalable, and flexible API platform. So, yeah. And just added to the schedule, Apprentice Program, which is about diversity, but specifically what they mean is getting more women into tech. So finding different ways of reaching out, making open source projects more inclusive, and educating on that, apprenticing women so that they can feel more comfortable coming in and being on a part of a development team and things like that. So that's going to be pretty cool. I don't think we've had a show similar to that. So this is probably coming into new directions. So yeah, an open mainframe. That rounds up the schedule we have for what we've got going on. So the mainframe has evolved to become the most secure and trusted hardware platform on the planet. Open source software has been rejuvenated the mainframe as a viable consolidation platform that both saves on licensing costs and enables technologies such as virtualization, cloud, containerization, and cryptography that are vital to survive in today's economy. Yeah, that sounds like a fun show too. So I can't imagine we would have anything that had the word mainframe in it on this show, but apparently they called me or they emailed me and they said, we've got some stuff we want to put on your show. And I said, okay, cool. I like that. Twitch.tv/floss is the homepage for this show. You can go there and see the upcoming schedule precisely, and you can also see who we're working on. If there's somebody not on that list, please have the project leader or community coordinator email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. My email address is on that page, so you don't have to write that down. Just remember twitch.tv/floss. That's all you have to remember. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twitch.tv. We take a number of questions from the chat room today. We always do. The number could be zero, but we always take a number of questions. I like that. Well, follow us at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You follow me at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. You can join us at the new twit.community forum. There is a specific channel for Floss Weekly there. I believe each show gets auto-posted to create a new thread. Maybe not. I've seen – okay. Okay, good. Yes, it does. Apparently, I've been whispered in my ear that yes, it does. There is no show Christmas or New Year's this year. It turns out that two Wednesdays in a row are holidays. So I actually get 2 weeks off this time. I typically only get one of those off. So, yeah, we got 2 weeks off this year. I am currently in Santa Monica. If you watch my if you tweet at me, it's probably the easiest way to get a hold of me on a real-time basis. I'm pretty busy, but I do have a couple gaps here and there in the schedule. So if you're in the Santa Monica area, feel free to ping me up. I don't really have anything special coming up after that. I don't have any conferences scheduled yet, thank God. I just made it through conference season. And the bad part about conference season is it's a double whammy on my my bottom line, because first off, I've got to pay to go to the conference. And second, I don't have billable hours for either the conference itself or typically the travel day before and after. So I've had like 8 or 9 conferences in the last 2 months, and my bottom line is itching a little. So anyway, anything you want to plug, Dan?
No, I mean, I would encourage people, if they're interested in pop culture, you know, films, comic books, TV, all that kind of stuff, to check out a podcast I do called Tales of the Unattested. Sadly, not Tales of the Unit Tested, as Randall always says, but we're going to do that spin-off one day. Yeah, if you go to unattested.club, you can find us there and you can hear us talk about that sort of thing, and come and say hello on Twitter.
Cool. And Dan, thanks for stepping in for the second week in a row. I think you're probably going to get a reprieve next week. I would hope you did. We've got to spread out the co-hosting responsibilities. So we'll see who steps up for next week. But thank you once again for joining me and interviewing this really talented, interesting guy. A great project, and glad you could come on and provide your expertise in it as well. So thanks a lot.
No problem. Always a pleasure.
Cool. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.